What's the difference? Question of the day. What is the difference between Lutherans and Presbyterians? Sounds like a bad joke is coming, right? But I actually mean to speak in a theological way. I'm talking about how both the Lutheran and the Reformed branch of the Protestant Church responded to the great changes that were happening in the early 16th century. Lutherans, named for Martin Luther, and the Reformed tradition starting out with Ulrich Zwingli and later John Calvin, each saw the task a bit differently. And you see that difference reflected in the way that the descendants of these various reformers order their worship and their government today. So if you attend Lutheran worship, you'll find it different than Calvinist worship. To the outside observer, a person might say that the Lutheran worship is more like a Catholic or an Episcopal service. Same for the form of government. Lutherans and Catholics have bishops. Not so for Presbyterians or Baptists, who are also part of the Reformed tradition. The metaphor for the difference is how you decide to clean out your kitchen drawer. And I'm talking about that big drawer at the bottom. That's where you find everything from sponges to light bulbs, screwdrivers, twist ties, batteries, all the stuff you can ever find when you need it. And every now and then you have to go through the process of cleaning out that big drawer at the bottom. So imagine that big drawer is the Roman Catholic Church of the year 1500. It's time for a reformation. The drawer has become too cluttered. So here's the difference between the Lutherans and the Calvinists. The Lutherans go through the drawer and they pick out all the stuff that they don't want in there any longer. They pull out the paper clips, old gum, outdated phone books. That gizmo that's still in its packaging that was supposed to serve some useful purpose, but you forgot why you bought it. They pull out all the stuff that they don't want anymore, but largely they leave the drawer the same in many ways. A lot of the stuff is still useful, and it should be in the drawer, is their reasoning. Now, the Calvinists are a bit more brutal. They pull the drawer all the way out of the cabinet and dump it on the kitchen floor. Then they say to themselves, this drawer will only have what I want in it. And so they pick out several items to keep, put them back in the drawer, and they throw the rest out. So if people ask you the difference between a Lutheran and a Presbyterian, that's basically it. Lutherans made some modifications, but kept a lot of the Roman Catholic tradition. Presbyterians dumped it all out and started over. Now I use this image to paint a picture of where we are in Christianity in America today. Some say we're in the midst of a reformation. The drawer is in need of tending. It's so full of stuff that we can barely open it. And once we open it, we can't find a thing. Well, with what is it filled? Well, it's filled with habits, idiosyncrasies, medieval worldviews, creeds, confessions, practices, styles, buildings, curriculum, salaried professionals, early 20th century business models, other pieces of the cultural kitchen drawer stuff that no longer is useful or even being used. It's just there. It needs tending. It's so jam-packed full, we can't get anything out of it. It kind of sits there. So how do we reform this drawer? Well, we can pick through it, throw out the stuff we don't want, or do we dump it out and start all over? Now, I have no judgment as to which one is the right way, or if there is one that's even better or worse. It is what it is. But it's important to know, first off, that the drawer is not filled with junk. It is filled with sacred icons, memories that recall people and great works of service. Just like the things in the drawer. Each item at one time served a purpose or had the potential to do so. And each item, as you actually go through it, sparks a memory. The drawer has perhaps some pretty cherished things, like photos that you were supposed to put in an album at one time, but they didn't quite make it, so they ended up in the drawer. And so you may find yourself, regardless of the method of reformation, where you pick it out or dump it all and start over, You might find yourself just sitting on the floor, feeling melancholy, eyes welling up a bit over the silly kitchen drawer, finding these objects that touch your heart. And that, of course, makes the Reformation much harder. For some, it's so hard that they won't or can't do it. Shut the drawer again and forget about it. They can't bear to reorder it. They may not even want to talk about cleaning out the drawer, and they aren't too thrilled about having someone else do it either. So it takes compassionate, patient persistence on behalf of those who know it needs to be done. It takes listening and thoughtfulness, good communication, a little bit of wisdom. This sermon series is based on Marcus Borg's book, Speaking Christian, Why Christian Words Have Lost Their Meaning and Power and How They Can Be Restored. The church's kitchen drawer is filled with churchy words, words that have been in the drawer for so long that their definitions have changed over the years, words that make up beliefs, words that evoke emotion, words that have defined us and still do for us, some more than others. Words that have been turning people away, even as others cling to them. Words that need to be revisited together in community. Some, like my colleague Greta Vosper in the United Church of Canada, she's a pull out the drawer, dump it on the floor, and start over kind of gal. For her and for her community, the words have lost their meaning. But there's an essence of the church that still survives, the ethic of love. So if you go to her community, West Hill United Church in Toronto, Canada, you'll find, according to reports, I haven't been there myself, I've just read about them and talked to Greta, of course, about it, but you'll find a community very much like our church that sings and reflects and gathers, just uses different words. It's a community for whom the words of the past have had so much negative baggage, they found it was just easier and more fulfilling to redefine their experience in words that make sense to them. Of course, as we know, others feel that their method of reformation is too brutal, outside the bounds of Christianity. The irony is, of course, the same thing was said of Martin Luther and Zwingli and Calvin by the Roman Church. They were outside the bounds. The further irony is that each of the reformers also excommunicated each other, because they didn't feel the others did it right either, and that's why we have 35,000 Christian denominations in the world. 12 different Presbyterian denominations in the United States. We have two different denominations within 500 feet of each other. Others reform gradually. Unlike Greta, they pick out a few things, make a change here and there, adding mother to the Lord's Prayer as opposed to dropping it altogether. This is hard work. It's hard because it requires us to be engaged with one another regarding matters of the heart, matters that may surprise us in regards to how much we cared when we didn't even think we did. Another friend of mine, Becky Garrison, who is a religion writer, has been talking about this Reformation. She doesn't hold too much hope for the gradual approach. She says that there are instead alternative spiritual communities, secular churches, so to speak, springing up all over. And they aren't church, really. The participants wouldn't describe them as church. According to Becky, they fill the void left by those who have left or who never participated in the first place in traditional church communities. Becky puts it this way: I need a community where people care if I die. That was the real power of what church has been. These are communities based on sacred dance or improv. You'll find them all in Portland. Sustainable farming, even cannabis. More than a club or an interest group, there's an ethic about them, a need to give something back to the world, to touch the heart, to discover authenticity, to accept those who've been left out, to care when one in their community dies, to touch. When we last met with our visitation team, that is our team that goes out and visits people who are temporarily not able to come to church or permanently so, Pat Eddy said something that stuck with me. She said that many people go through a whole week without ever being touched, people that we see in the community here. a touch on the arm, a connection, I'm glad you're here, can do more for human dignity, worth, and reaching the depth of joy than we may realize. Thomas Kratenmaker is a reformer too. This is the text that Sandy read. He, like me, I suppose, has a heart for Jesus, but not as a supernatural figure or God. Jesus, the teacher of ethics, the poet, the visionary, too good to toss out with the rest of the stuff in the drawer. For Tom, he doesn't find the creeds or the Trinity or the miracles or any of that very interesting. It's a barrier, actually. For him, Jesus represents the correction to a life of disappointment and depression within ourselves and among us as human beings. And so he calls himself a secular Jesus follower. Jesus is worth keeping as a model for challenging us to live beautiful lives. Does he count? Is he Christian enough? Does it matter? Dr. Mehta. I met Dr. Mehta when I lived in Johnson City, Tennessee. He's an internal specialist. He'll work on your spleen if you need it. He's about internal matters in other ways, too. He's from India and an expert in a delightfully folksy way about Hinduism. And he introduced me to the concept of the Ishta Deva. The Ishta Deva is the chosen deity. You see, Hinduism has about 300 million gods, give or take. Too many for one person to take seriously. So you choose one. You choose your Ishta Deva. You pick a god or a goddess that comforts you or challenges you, and you devote yourself to the god. Krishna, Ganesh, Lakshmi. With 300 million, there are enough gods for everyone. And you don't care. You pick yours, and your neighbor picks somebody else. It's fine. Nobody's worrying that you got the right one and she has the wrong one. You devote, you emulate, you become, or you're always in the process of becoming your Ishta Deva. So as I thought about that, I thought, wow, that's what Jesus is to me, the historical Jesus, the radical poet and revolutionary. He'd make a great Ishta Deva, challenging, comforting, character building. And just because, of course, I choose him as my Ishta Deva doesn't mean you have to. You can choose a different figure altogether or a different aspect of Jesus. There are plenty to go around. Does that count? Is it Christian enough? Does it matter? But I also choose to choose my Jesus, not in isolation, but in relationship with a community that stretches back in time, that stretches across the globe, and intimately with people I see and know and yet hope to know. And each of you opens my eyes to another aspect of Jesus for me. Now, I like to throw out the term Christian atheist, in part because it's so marvelously jarring, but also because it describes what many people find in themselves. They resonate with many aspects of the faith, but many of the beliefs just aren't worth the trouble. The God of the Middle Ages no longer inspires. So many versions of God are so bland or incredible or damaging that the only response is a courageous atheism. The earliest Christians were accused by the Romans in their time of being atheists because they didn't find the gods of the society interesting or helpful. But I say Christian atheist because, unlike some other atheists, I value religion. I don't want to throw out the drawer itself, even as I may not be consistent in how to clean it. Jesus. Jesus is a churchy word because Jesus is, in one sense, a creation of the church. But Jesus also transcends church and perhaps can be a guide in how we go about reforming the church. His parables are a good place to start. But that's just my story. You each have your story. Let's share them and see what we can do about that kitchen drawer.